It is the Chad Benson Show on a Friday. Joining us here, author, two amazing authors, but also some people that are very talented in the world of entertainment across the board. They got a new book out called Gratitude and Trust, Six Affirmations That Will Change Your Life. Paul Williams and Tracy Jackson, thank you guys so much for coming.
Oh, Chad, thank we're you, so Chad. Happy to be here.
You know what? It's you guys were fighting the traffic, and it's the season, and not everything's complete down there. Flashing lights, and
flashing
we appreciate you guys
lights.
Fighting through that.
But at least the flashing red lights weren't behind us. They were on
That's
the
street. They could have been, because I went through a red light and got
25 years ago, they would have been behind us. You know?
So here it is. You got a great book out, and it's a book that is it's a very interesting look. It's you basically have taken a lot of what people go through in recovery, the steps and whatnot, and you want people to apply them to their normal everyday kind of life. People who are non-addicts, if you will.
The original title was
Gratitude and Trust. Recovery is not just for addicts.
Yeah, you know, for 24 years, people have been saying to me, "I wish I had something like you did. You were face down in your spittle, you know, and you disappeared for a decade. You know, you're an alcoholic when you misplace a decade. You know, you were gone for 10 years, and all of a sudden, you're back. You have a full, rich life. Why don't we have something like what you have?" And talking, you know, Tracy said, "There's a book there." You know, I mentioned that my choo-choo runs on the twin rails of gratitude and trust, and she went, "You have a choo-choo?" No, she went, "There's a book there."
And you guys put this together, and you guys, I mean, because both of like you here's Paul Williams. You're famous. You've got everything in the world going for you. You've Academy Award.
Yeah.
You've got the Grammys. You are, you know, you're the who's who. And at times, maybe at the 70s and certain parts of the 80s, you may have been one of the biggest stars out there. And then all of a sudden, misplaced a decade.
You know what? I misplaced a decade, but long before that, I misplaced any gratitude for what I was getting and for the opportunities I was getting. I was, the lights began to go out, the more cocaine in the eye. Get up in the morning, have a glass of vodka in the shower, power up with a little cocaine, and then not do anything. Then just serve that whore that was my addiction.
Which is, again, and for me, it's totally different. I've never had a drink in my life. I've never tasted alcohol in my life.
You're the one. Oh, wow.
I am the guy. I've never had a smoke. Stop it, Jeremy. Yeah. I've never done any of those things in my life, but I grew up around, my whole family was alcoholics. My father died of a drug overdose. My life was one of those things where I grew up around it. My sister took a different path, but I never had any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I just said, that's not for me. But, you've come to this because you...
Yeah, I never did anything either.
But you've got issues with, you said, men and cigarettes and things like that.
Yeah, the cigarette, I don't know why the cigarette, I think the cigarette thing might be sort of slightly overblown. I didn't smoke that many, but no question. I mean, a lot of family issues and totally, addicted to men or addicted to men for all the wrong reasons for a lot of years. But there's a chapter we have in the book called Reaching for a Bottle of Disappointment. I would always go for what was going to be wrong. A lot of people push the pleasure button and a lot of people push the pain button. And it just depends on what you want, you're pushing, but you get addicted to a lot of different kinds of emotions, right?
Absolutely.
So like you, I never smoked dope. I never took drugs. I didn't, I have a glass of wine. I'm done because, I'm terrified of authority. But, there's other ways of messing up your life. And there's other ways of just dealing with, sugar addiction. Huge.
Oh, massive.
Massive.
My Diet Coke is my addiction. I have an addiction. It's Diet Coke. I love Diet Coke.
I have a way for you to get out of that, incidentally, that is easy and amazing.
But I want one addiction, right?
Yeah, but here's what
Paul, you
can
had three Diet Cokes yesterday.
Oh, my God. What happened to this?
Honesty is apparently not an addiction.
Well, no, rigorous. No, but here, when I'm at home, I take a glass of ice water. I put liquid stevia in it. A few drops of lemon-flavored liquid stevia, it totally satisfies that urge for a Coke. When I'm away from home, I'll have a Diet Coke now and then, of course.
Or three.
But I sip at it. And I did not have... She said that for the joke. She did not say it for the truth.
I said that you did.
Yeah, I did.
I said that for the
truth. All right, that's it. This partnership is over. Chad, you want to write a book together?
Absolutely. I am fantastic. I got a lot of stuff going through my mind. I failed my way to the top. That's going to be my book. Gratitude and Trust, Six Affirmations That Will Change Your Life. Paul Williams and Tracy Jackson. Now, when did you know you had a problem, Tracy, with the wrong kind of things, in men?
I think that I never really tilted so far into a place that I couldn't come back. I'm a control freak. What I have is I have recovery envy. And so my whole life, not my whole life, but let's maybe take back 20 years, I was really envious of people who had recovery.
Really?
Yeah, because I really loved what happened to them. I loved the principles. I loved the camaraderie. I loved the honesty. I loved the apologies. I loved the fact that these people were honest emotionally, even if they didn't always talk about how much Diet Coke they drank. But I really...
drink a lot.
They drink a lot. But I love that. And, you know, it's not that I was ever completely amiss in my life, but there were things that really didn't work out. You know, like certainly up until I was 40, I really didn't know what a good relationship was, even though I had a failed marriage kind of nestled in there. I had a lot of problems with my father, a lot of rejection, a lot of psychological abuse even. So I went through a lot of pain and problems. I just chose not to self-medicate with booze. Shopping, huge shopping addiction. Yeah, I would have to say there's anything that really probably was my Achilles heel would be out of shopping.
And you
addiction.
Wrote about that, obviously.
And I wrote about it in Confessions of a Shopaholic. But yeah, that would be how I would self-soothe. You know, someone goes out and has a drink or has a toot or does something, I go and buy a pair of shoes. I mean, you know, or two. So that was a big thing. And I think, you know, thinking I didn't deserve to be happy, Chad. I was really addicted to the notion I didn't deserve happiness.
Well, I think in the industry, like in the entertainment industry and stuff, you can find a lot of those people who feel like, you know, that tomorrow it's all going to go away. You don't deserve to be happy. Yeah. You're always looking for something to out there.
Absolutely. In my case, I go from being this weird little guy. You know, I wanted to be an actor. I felt like Montgomery Clift. I looked like Haley Mills. It was just, you know, it wasn't going to happen.
Which is great for Haley, but not for you.
It's great for Haley, but not for me. But the fact is that the career that I wanted as an actor never really happened at all. Noah's a Gift, because when that didn't happen, I started writing songs. And eventually, because I started, you know, recording and to support the albums and promote them, started doing television, all of a sudden I'm on the tube, as you pointed out, all the time. And I have I've made this huge leap from different to special. Well, special's addicting to me. I mean, something happened where I felt that amount of love coming at me, and that became a huge focus. And I would have stayed with that, except the other addiction outran it and all. But, you know, the addiction to the alcohol and the cocaine outran that. But I think that in the midst of it, as I'm standing there holding the Oscar, there's some part of me that goes, you know what, you don't belong here. There's some little place in the center of the chest that goes, wait till they find out. And that's what you medicate. That's part of it, especially the cocaine. You know, alcohol made me, you know, booze made me feel big enough to deal with the rest of the world. I've always said that cocaine made me feel big enough to I could shoot basketball for money. It was the great, you know, it was the turbocharger to the ego and to the confidence that I didn't have.
Talking to Paul Williams and Tracy Jackson, our new book's out now, and it's really cool. I was going through a lot of it over the last couple of days. Gratitude and Trust, 6 Affirmations That Will Change Your Life. Now, Paul, you when did you get into drugs? I mean, was it before Hollywood, or did Hollywood suck you into it?
You know, I was a construction brat. My dad was in construction. At like 5 or 6, we were over having a
because you have two brothers, right? One's a NASA guy, and the other one wrote Dobie Gray's Big Hit.
Give me the beat, boys, and my brother wrote Driftway, exactly. You know, and my older brother was an engineer. He passed away. He was sober when he died. My younger brother is also sober. We have there's a strong genetic component in who we are to become alcoholics. I think we got part of that. But when I was a little kid, we'd have a drink of our dad's beer. We'd have a little glass of beer and all. I don't think that I loved the way that alcohol made me feel. I loved the ritual of hanging with my buddies, like in high school, and let's get drunk, throw up, and be somebody. The fact that I was one of the guys, and we were doing this together, and all of a sudden they kind of grew up and went to college and moved on with their lives, and I just started getting a little more and a little more and a little more. I don't know when I crossed the line from use to abuse to addiction, but I'm sure that I was well into it by the middle of the 70s. By the 80s, you know, the career was so huge in the 70s. I was so blessed and so fortunate.
I mean, because you had working with, you know, Kara Carpenter, and you were working, you know, you had the Oscar, you had everything, and you were untouchable at that time.
Yeah. Well, you know, and then I went away. And the fact is that alcoholism is a progressive disease, and I hit a point where I couldn't leave the house, you know. I met Tracy in the midst of that. I tell the story of media. We met in Robert Mitchum's bedroom.
Well,
and she walked in, and Mitchum,
that's where I met Jeremy, actually.
Yeah. We were getting high, and she walked in and said,
not
the
me.
Most, no, not Tracy, Mitchum and I, the goose. I called him the goose. He called me the doughboy. He'd go, doughboy, this shit's no good. I shouldn't say that in the air. This is no good, but you might like it. And then he'd give you something that was scraped off King Tut, you know, and to smoke and all. But Tracy walked in and said something really sweet and loving, like, I really have always loved your music. And I just said, you know, something arrogant and shallow and sexist and stupid. And she said, you know, I said, well, if it helps you get laid, you know. And she spun on her heels and walked out of the room and went, what, you know, forget him. He's a creep, you know.
Well, so much that's not very nice, huh, Tracy?
Yeah.
I played Neil Diamond all the way home in the car. I went, so much for childhood idols.
Now,
Tracy.
Me at my worst.
You, here you are, you had the envy of it all. But like you said, for somebody outside of the addiction world, a lot of times they don't have that rock bottom that other people do. So it's hard to have to have that kind of envy. And I think, how are you drawn into something like this when you really don't have that, you know, in the gutter moment, I got arrested for something kind of thing?
You know, I think that's what the really interesting line of this is, because people assume that you got to, you know, that you're sort of Sid Vicious lying there with a needle hanging out of your arm, or you're really down to your last 4 cents and you're sitting in a flop house or something. We all have stuff that takes us down.
Yeah.
And I've had periods in my life where, you know, I may not have been rock bottom, but certainly I was really in a place where I wasn't where I wanted to be. I wasn't happy in my relationships. I might not have been fulfilled in my career. I was making poor choices based on fear, based on all sorts of things that really weren't real. I think everyone, if they look at their lives honestly, I was working with a guy tonight on this, you know, make a list. Where are the sinkholes in your life? We all have them.
Yeah, absolutely.
We all have them. And usually, Chad, they go back to our childhood. Very few people will say, God, you know, I had this run-in with this guy when I was 42, and it's just totally freaked me out and ruined me forever. People don't really do that, But you go back to, you know, something your father did, your stepfather did, your mother did, you know, whoever it may be in your life, your siblings. We all have stuff that we usually glossed over, because when you're a kid, you don't know how to deal with that stuff. So you find ways of either, you know, drinking the way Paul did when he was young, you know, other ways. With me, I started, you know, with guys when I was like 14. That was how I did. I handled it, you know, inappropriately and unconsciously, but I was looking for love in all the wrong places for many decades. So I think that we do it in different ways. And I think part of the real trick is to look at your life and go, okay, I don't want to hit rock bottom. You know, I don't want to max out the credit cards until my house is taken away. I don't want to like gamble until I don't have anything. I don't want to be so self-sabotaging that I have no friends left, that nobody wants to hire me, that nobody wants to date me, I don't want to get to that place. So you kind of got to stop yourself midstream and look at your life really, really objectively.
Yeah, which I don't think a lot of, and I think for a lot of people that is tough to do, to stand back and go, you know what, I got a problem here, and I can change myself.
Well, we're the fine people. You know what I mean? I think that we live in a society where we project is everything is fine. Yeah. What I love about recovery, Chad, is people in recovery stand up in front of rooms week after week after week, and they go, this is where I messed up. This is where I'm not okay. This is where I'm afraid. This is where I wasn't nice to my wife last night. This is where and they like, they own their stuff, and they're applauded for it, and they're comforted by it. And in real life, or life outside of that, we don't do that. No. We're shameful and we hide, and people go, how are you doing? And maybe you're just awful, and you go, I'm fine. And the fine is stuffing those feelings, and you just perpetuate it, and it's horrible.
Which takes us to the, and you started to do it there. You owned it. You said, yeah, that's our first affirmation. Something needs to change, and it's probably me. It's that moment when you own where you've been, what you've done. You look at it and you go, the situation may not change, but I can. I have to.
All right, when we come back, we're going to pick it up from there. Gratitude and Trust, 6 Affirmations That Will Change Your Life. Paul Williams, Tracy Jackson here. It's a new book. It's amazing. We're going to pick it up from there. When we come back, it's the Chad Benson Show. K-News, 94.3 FM, 970 AM.
We've only just begun.
Wow, that sounds familiar, eh, Paul?
Yeah, I know that. Oh, bless her heart. You know.
Paul Williams right here with us. Tracy Jackson, what an absolutely great song. And he's got a new book out along with Tracy Jackson called Gratitude and Trust, 6 Affirmations That Will Change Your Life. And you hear something like that, Paul. What does it take you back to those days?
Oh, you know, it's the longer I'm alive, the less I feel like I have to do with some of those songs. But, you know, probably because I really recognize what a gift it is to have anything like that kind of pass through you, and to have somebody like Karen Carpenter sing it. I mean, she was an angel.
Oh, yeah. I was bottle fed on the Carpenters, and I still listen to the Carpenters. I have like their 4-disc set. I'll pop it open and I'll be at the gym You know, people are listening to that thump, 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 and I'm listening to the Carpenters. You know,
oh my God,
my
I love that. I love that. Thank you. That's yeah. That's a hard payment.
Now,
I love
was
that.
It that that song was? Did I
had all the romantic beginnings of a bank commercial?
I was just about to say that it was a couple getting married. It was a bank commercial where we first heard
I sang
that.
It in the commercial, and Richard saw it, and he went, "Is there a full song?" I went, "Funny you should ask." Yeah, and the number one album at the time was in Agata DeVita. There's no way in the world this song was ever going to be a hit. And then Karen sang it, and when she sang it, something clicked. It was just and the world responded. It was great.
And that's, you know, I mean, again, it's things like when you hear things like that. But the fact is you know, you were white hot for a very long time. You won an Academy Award. You got the Grammys. You said you did 48 times with Carson. And you know, because of that, though, you're able to do something like this and appreciate that stuff probably far more and be able to help. So, like Tracy said earlier, this is the best thing she could ever do for anybody, is to write this book to help people.
It's the most important thing I've ever been involved with. This is, you know, her turning to me and saying, "Let's write this book," has been the greatest gift of them all, maybe.
Now, you said
next,
how you,
next to my recovery.
Next to your recovery is the best thing you've ever done.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you said you guys met. She walks in on you, and then she goes home listening to Neil Diamond because you're a jerk. A misogynistic jerk.
A black belt in whoops.
How did you guys eventually end up meeting and becoming this duo?
This dynamic duo. Well, you know, time went on, and I went to L.A., and I had a career, and I had
TikTok.
Actually a TikTok. And I had an... I didn't forget Paul. You know, I always had his music. I still have this funky little cassette from when I was a kid. But I had an overall deal at Sony in television in the beginning of my career. And I went in the first day and they said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "You know, I'd love to do a show for Paul Williams." I don't know where that came from. I just went, "I want to do a show for Paul Williams." And they said, "If you back the cocaine truck up into the lot, then you could." So that was like a definitive no. You know, I got that. I went off and did a show for Alex Rocco instead.
And they were right.
And
they knocked that out of the park.
Alex Rocco didn't do any drugs. And time went on. I moved to New York, and I was reading an article one day in the New York Observer, written by a guy called George Gurley, I now know, about Paul, how he had a comeback. He was having a comeback. It wasn't like a big comeback, but he was performing at Feinstein's, and how he was sober. And it was, you know, they kind of, you know, a what happened to kind of article. And so I said to my husband, "I've got to go see Paul Williams. I love Paul Williams." He's like, "You love Paul Williams?" I went, "Yeah." So we went to see him, and I didn't go backstage because I didn't want to bug him, but I wrote him a note and left it off the next day, and he answered me, and then we've been friends ever since.
We've been friends ever since. And
so
I wanted
like
to.
Eight, six, five, 15 years ago, something?
That was 2001.
I can't keep dates straight anymore.
It was 2001, and we became, you know, what are we going to do together? And we became great friends. We became best friends. And then it was a matter of let's do something together. And after it was after a screening of Still Alive that I said that my choo-choo runs on gratitude and trust. She said, "There it is. That's the book. Let's write a book. Let's take, you know, because, you know, the person she met in 2001 was not the person she met in 1982. You know, there was a major shift. And she had before that been best friends with a friend that she dedicates, he passed away, but a friend in recovery that she dedicates the book to, Blake Snyder. And she'd seen these amazing changes in Blake, saw those changes in me, and said, "Let's, you know, what about sharing that with the world?" And the thing is that I owe my recovery to a recovery resource, a way of getting sober that we don't talk about at a public level. So how are we going to do this? You know, we found a way where we can write in a single voice in the book about the process and all, but then we go into our individual stories. I tell my story, she tells hers, and it's just been a gift. It's been a gift. And again, it's very simple affirmation. One, something needs to change, and it's probably me. Two, I don't know how to do this, but something inside me does. Three, my favorite, I will learn from my mistakes and not defend them. You know, for, as I say, I've got a black belt in whoops. For somebody from, like, I think for all of us to have those kind of very simple steps to move into a place where you can put, you know, parts of your life shiny side up, that you've screwed up. And we all have parts of our lives that we've screwed up.
I mean, if you don't have parts in your life you don't screw up, you're probably not living at all, because you're going to make mistakes in life, and that's what it is. But it's owning up to your mistakes and then realizing, "I made mistakes, I got to fix this and move on with my life."
It's also, you know, using your mistakes as your classroom. I mean, the best information any of us ever get is when we goof up. I mean, and people look at their mistakes and they push them in the closet and they stick them in the back drawer and they make excuses and they explain them away and they justify them away and they blame them on other people. Instead of taking them out and looking at them and go, what can I learn from this? I mean, you know, when you start using your mistakes every day as a way of learning, you embrace them. You're like, okay, now what's in this for me? What's, you know, Paul and I have an experience. There's a lot of information in that. And if you can look at it as all the information the universe is sending your way and your mistakes are the universe's classroom for you.
I used to always say that, you know, failure and mistakes are the roadmap to success.
Absolutely.
Because you're not
going
to be able to move forward without making mistakes a lot of times.
Exactly. And again in my life, no is a gift. That's the other thing, is that I don't get something I want. I get something that I need and all. The other thing about that moment when you make a mistake and you really look at it and you really own it, there's a lot of information on that about who you need to look for and set things right. It's that amends element of it, you know, I will learn from my mistakes and not defend them, but then I will go out and put my life, the people that I've managed to offend, damage, hurt. Let's go out and find those people and make right the wrongs we've done on a daily basis.
Which I think is great. And I think, and even if you're not addicted to anything, and that's one of the things I teach in recovery, is to go out and you apologize, you try to make amends in some way. Even if you're not, there's a lot of things in life that, you know, we mess people over, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. And we should be able to say, you know, hey, look, I messed up, man. That was my bad. I'm sorry about that. And a lot of people are afraid to do that.
Totally. And they also, you know, and the greatest place to do it is with your kids. And most parents never do it with their kids.
No.
You know, I mean, most parents, and we probably all grew up of a generation. Well, you're younger than we are, but parents never apologize to you. Yeah, you know?
They never said.
You know, your dad probably never said, "I'm drinking, and it's not your fault. This is my stuff." You know what I mean? You just sort of walk around and you pretend daddy doesn't drink usually. Time you pretend daddy's not angry. You pretend your parents are happy. And the thing about kids is, kids know the truth. Kids see through a bad marriage, an alcoholic. They know something's wrong, but they're constantly being told something's right or it's all okay.
Like you said earlier with, we're fine.
We're fine. Yeah. But you know what kids learn then? Kids learn not to trust their own instincts. And they learn not to trust their feelings. Because what they're being told time and time again is what you're feeling is not the truth. The truth is what we're telling you is the truth. And that's the worst thing you can do, because then you walk around half your life going, what I'm feeling isn't right. It's not authentic. It sets the compass wrong from day one. So for a parent to be able to go in and go, you know what? I'm screwing up. I've got a problem. It has nothing to do with you. It's the best gift you can give your kid.
It is. Now, this book, it's for everybody. It's not, you know, again,
everybody.
Whether somebody's in business, whether somebody's, you know, having trouble with relationships or life, that's what I found so amazing about this.
There's so many different areas that we cover in the book. I mean, there's a chapter called Navigating the Nasties. Navigating the Nasties is purely about dealing with people that are a mess in your life, and they're not going to change, you know, but they're in your life and they're permanent. They are attached nasties. And you're going to, whether it's a member of the family, whether it's your boss, whatever, somebody that you're not going to be able to run away from who is just awful. How do you deal with that? Well, something needs to change, and it's probably me. If I change the way that I relate to somebody, if I take away that little button that they keep pushing to make me jump, you know, that little bruise they keep poking, if I begin to adjust the way I relate to this person, everything will change.
Change
the way you respond.
And set boundaries. You know, learning to set boundaries.
Right.
A lot of us have
huge.
A really hard time setting. So you can have someone in your life who you can't get rid of, who you're supposed to love. I mean, you know, How to Love the Unlovable. It's probably our next book.
There's a bumper sticker right there.
Oh, God.
You know,
Loving the Unlovable.
Loving the
Unlovable.
I was thinking about that today. Loving the Unlovable. But, you know, what do you do? And I was, for years, Chad, I had the hardest time setting boundaries. I mean, it just, like, I could not do it. And it's a really important thing to do. Like, you know, I'm not going to throw you out. I'm not going to talk to you. But I'm going to have this fence, like a dog fence that zaps, but it's not a mean zap, where you can't cross over.
Yeah.
And how many people do that? You know, they either walk away permanently, then they come back, and then there's this push me,
or
pull
learning how to say no
thing
to stuff without hurting people's feelings.
Oh, yeah.
I think
oh
it's
my
such
God.
A hard thing for people to do.
You know, and for an alcoholic, the response to that, you know, you come up against those moments where you're going to say no to somebody or you tell them the truth about something that you've done. And what with alcoholics, I mean, I became a chronic and habitual liar. in the midst of my addiction, where it was just easier to tell them what they wanted to hear at the moment instead of what was really going on at that. That's a character flaw that has to be dealt with. And the way out of that is telling the truth. The way out of that is, you know, you start admitting to these things. You begin to grab it and say, this is mine, this is my mistake, and your world gets bigger and the weight on your shoulder gets lighter, and it's the greatest gift I've ever been given.
Well, you know, it's fabulous. And you guys are going to be on with Oprah next week.
Super Soul Sunday, the 16th.
And
Oprah has this great thing she talks about, and you just kind of stirred that. I mean, but you know, the disease to please. Because, you know, I mean, I was a people pleaser. I mean, I still suffer from it, too, and I have to stop myself. But, you know, how many of us are people pleasers, right? Yeah. So we, like you just said about saying no, like we say yes to stuff we don't want to do. We say yes to people we don't want to be with. We fall into this trap because we have a disease to please.
Yeah.
And kids who grow up in dysfunctional families always have a disease to please because you figure you're going to please the pain away.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to please the boo-boo away. You're going to please the problem away. And you can't please someone else into happiness. They got to go get it for themselves.
And the amount of time you save. If somebody asks me if I want to go fishing.
You want to go fishing?
Okay, now I have a phobia about fish hooks. I know at the moment you ask me that I don't want to go fishing. But what do I respond? My natural response is going to be, when are you going? You know, it's like, and it's like, well, I'm going on Saturday. Well, let me get back to you. I'm now wasting your time and my time because I don't know how to say to you, I don't like to fish. I'm afraid of fish hooks flying through the air. I'm afraid I'll lose an eye. I mean, it's just, I hate fishing. I'm sorry. All you fishermen, I apologize. Enjoy yourselves. I love the fish you catch, but I don't want to be out there bobbing around on the water with fish hooks flying. I know that. But the ability to just reach into the center of my chest and say, go ahead. Tell them the truth. It took me rehab twice to get to the point where I could do that.
Talking to Paul Williams and Tracy Jackson, they got a new book out. I want you guys to stay around for one quick more segment before we get out of here because I got a couple other questions. It's the Chad Benson Show. It's KNews, 34.3 FM, 970 AM. We're rocking out in here. We're on the road. She's on the road a lot.
On the road a lot.
Tracy Jackson, Paul Williams, the great Paul Williams, the great Tracy Jackson. Now superstar authors. And, you know, it's great having you guys in here. And I was, you know, before you went in, we were going away. I love listening to you, you know, you talk about stuff because I think a lot of people in a position, you know, you had so much fame at one time. You were the it person probably in Hollywood. And, you know, a lot of people, they don't want to relive those kind of things, but you're fine talking about it, which I think is great.
You know, the fact is that's not who I am. You know, my connection to the world for so long was through my songs. And it was kind of a sort of a once removed place that was actually, you know, kind of, you know, there's a certain element of being alone in that and all. When I finally, you know, finally hit my knees and was about to die of my addiction, turned up a bunch of people I didn't know and said, you got to help me. For the first time, instead of saving my face, I was saving my life.
Yeah.
You know? And all of a sudden, I had that one-on-one connection, and I found what I've been looking for. I mean, I have never been happier in my life. The last 24 years have been the most spectacular years, and my connection to people feels, you know, I mean, like Tracy will tell you, walking through an airport, anybody wants to stop and talk.
You never know who you get. Because, I mean, you're in this business long enough, you're going to interview hundreds of people, and sometimes they're just the worst people you've ever met. And you think to yourself, you just suck. You two are like the coolest people in the world. You guys taking pictures, you're tweeting, you're talking. Everybody wants to take a picture, doesn't it? You know, I thought, okay, cool. You know, what are they going to be like? You know, if you ask them questions about stuff, because sometimes, like, I don't want to talk about this or I don't want. You guys aren't like that.
I will talk. We talk about anything. I mean, you know, there's stuff you can't talk about because we're on the air. But no, it's.
Yeah,
but
the conversation in here is really.
But
she puts up with a lot of stuff. She puts up with a lot of questions about Smokey and the Bandit.
I get really sick of that. Smokey and the Bandit.
Little Enos.
God, please spare me any more Smokey and the Bandit. Some guy came in the night with a car. I'm like, just Smokey and the Bandit. But no, I think, you know what? I think the important thing, and that's part of what this book does, I hope, it's you got to talk about stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's always been my whole career. I've talked about stuff. I mean, if we don't talk about stuff, we're isolated.
That's the healing road.
We live in isolation. We live in fear. We live in shame. Everyone's got the same stuff in one version or another. That's what this book is. No matter who you are, you can be a celebrity, you can be a waiter. I don't care who you are, what you've done. We all have a connection in the same kind of stuff. And if we talk about it, we're all sort of together in it. And
That's the right thing.
People feel really isolated, especially now with the phones. Everything is like, you know, we're all one step away from a reality. Our reality is this really weird thing. And you want to talk about an addiction? I mean, how many of your listeners right now have thought for 2.5 seconds they lost their phone and you flip out,
panic,
right?
Panic.
I see people on Facebook who will freak out because their phone has fallen in the water, something's happened to it, and they can't contact me here, as if they've lost connection with the universe. I used to live in a world where we had rotary phones. Okay, we got about 30 seconds. Best thing you've had happen, if somebody's come up to you and said, I read your book.
Psychiatrist and a priest. Go for it.
A priest found that it helped his way to his spiritual practice. We've had psychiatrists who said they send their patients. But you know what? Actually, there's a better thing really fast. A guy came to a thing the other night in Denver. He said he came just because he liked Smokey and the Bandit. And he walked in and he went, you know what? I realize sitting here, I have so many problems I have to go home and deal with. It's when you turn the light on for someone. Priests are great, but they're just, you know, you're preaching the converted. When you turn on the light when someone's in the dark, that's a great moment.
Amen. Can you say amen?
Amen. Gratitude and trust. 6 affirmations that will change your life. Paul Williams, Tracy Jackson, go out, get the book now. You're going to love it. It will change your life. It's a great book. Thank you guys so very much.
You rock, Chad.
You're fantastic,
we love you.
Chad.
Whoa.
We all love Chad.
Can we come back for the paperback?
Absolutely.
All right.
We're on our way.
All right. Thank you guys so very much. Have yourself a wonderful weekend. For Jeremy Hovey, Paul Williams, Tracy Jackson, I'm Chad Benson. Night-night, Jack.